Welcome to the Dignity and Respect in Action podcast. This series is brought to you by the UMass Office of Equity and Inclusion and features members of the university community and other experts in the field of diversity, equity, and inclusion. In these episodes, we'll learn about the work and experiences of our guests and gain insight from their expertise. Your host for this podcast is Dr. Nefertiti Walker, Interim Vice Chancellor of Equity and Inclusion and Professor of Sport Management in the Eisenberg School of Management. And now, here's Nef.
Hello, and thank you for tuning in to the Dignity and Respect in Action podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Nef Walker. Today is the third episode in our series of podcasts for Black History and Heritage Month that will celebrate the Black experience at UMass. In our last episode, we hung out with Dominique Price, UMass alumnus and creator of the Blacked Out Game, about the importance of teaching Black history and making it fun and accessible. Today, I have the pleasure of welcoming Dr. Jamila Liscott and Dr. Keisha Green, faculty in the College of Education and directors of the UMass Center for Racial Justice and Youth Engaged Research. We will discuss the importance of centering racial justice in education and research. Thank you both so much for being here with me today. I'm excited, have been excited for this conversation for quite some time, so thank you.
Thanks for having us,
yeah.
Of course. So let's get started with just an introduction. I like to, we post a bio with the podcast, so we have your very formal accolades, right, and your titles, but tell us a little bit about yourselves and what you do here at UMass, as well as at the Center for Racial Justice.
You want to jump in, Dr. Green?
I was going to say, Nef, you might have to call on someone. Well, first, thank you so much for having us on the podcast, and we love the idea of the podcast, and appreciate engaging with you and meeting you, so thank you.
Absolutely.
Let's see, by way of introductions, these are always interesting for me, because I feel like I should say something like, well, I was born in South Carolina.
That's important, yeah.
I am Southern, you know, I'm born and raised in South Carolina, so I have Southern sensibilities, even though I haven't lived there since I was 17, really. So I grew up thinking that I would be the next Lorraine Hansberry. And so I like to tell that story because that's how I ended up in New York at NYU for grad school. And so after college, I really wanted to live in the city. And I thought that, you know, I would recreate my own Harlem Renaissance and live in New York and be a writer and literally sit at the typewriter with my cigarette and write the next, you know, major Black piece. But I tell that story to say that I was enamored, you know, by Black writers and literature. And that was something that I got a lot of in my community, in my home, not necessarily in schools. And so that's important as it relates to what I am interested in now as a teacher educator. And so after leaving South Carolina, I lived in New York City. I went to NYU for journalism school, and that was just my way of really having a community to be a part of immediately in the city. So as a small town girl, I felt like if I was, you know, part of a program that would situate me safely in this big, scary city, right? You know, that's what the perception is outside of the city. And so really what that allowed for me is to get all over in each borough and really get to know the city in a way that I don't think I would have otherwise. And so, you know, I was able to take the train from one end to the other. And really, so while I was raised and, you know, born in South Carolina, I feel like I grew up while living in Brooklyn and living in New York. Mm-hmm. It's a place that, you know, you have dreams, you pursue them, you have multiple dreams, you pursue all of them. Folks are hustling, and you know, I really resonated with the vibe. And so that's where I really enjoyed stories and talking to people. That's probably the first taste of ethnography that I got through journalism. And so fast forward a little bit to today, that experience led to me teaching at Medgar Evers College, which I like to say is the HBCU of the CUNY system. Mm-hmm. And at Medgar Evers College, I met Dr. Brenda Green, who, interesting fact, is Talib Kweli's mom. And she really pulled me into the Center for Black Literature that she runs there. And that's the place where, you know, any Black writer you name has been through that conference. And so through that experience, I really got a taste for teaching in higher ed and working in higher ed and engaging primarily Black folk in higher ed. And so I really was interested in pursuing a doctorate that would allow me to continue doing that work and allow me to ask questions and write and research and travel and continue what started out as journalism, but ended up being ethnographic work and thinking a lot about how we make decisions about what we teach, how folks are empowered to create a curriculum that resonates with folks who look like me, and why as a young girl, I didn't have those experiences and how I might intervene in that and disrupt that. So today I find that I'm at UMass Amherst. I'm a teacher educator. I also love documenting what young people do outside of schools as a way to teach us about what is possible inside schools or what's possible for education, since schooling is a whole, that's a whole nother thing. But yeah, I like hanging out with young people. I like engaging in work that disrupts what, scholarship, like conventional scholarship that frames Black and brown youth as underperforming, lagging behind white counterparts. And, you know, you start with that statement, that problem that situates Black and brown youth in deficit ways. And I like engaging with educators who see the possibilities in nurturing Black genius, nurturing Black joy, the whole Black child. And so, you know, really thinking about how you might learn from unintended contexts or unexpected ways where, you know, young people are really engaged in literacy learning and development. And so that's where I am today. And super excited to be a co-dreamer, co-visionary with my colleague, Dr. Jamila Liscott. Let me find out. So yeah, it's really a pleasure to hold all of it. So I really feel like through the center, I can hold my circular background and experience under the center umbrella. And so it's really an opportunity to take all of what my journey has been and use it in a way that.
Thank you. That's awesome. Dr. J.
Yes. So my name is Dr. Jamila Liscott, AKA Dr. J. I am born and raised in Brooklyn all day. And my family is Trini. So I come with that Caribbean flavor. And I'm a scholar activist, a poet. There's just so many things, I'm excited to be in this work with the center as a co-director here, following my title as a professor of social justice education here at UMass Amherst. And I'm always excited, just to echo everything that Dr. Green shared, I'm just always excited for the spaces in particular where Black genius is thriving and honored and valued, where we find refuge to sustain who we are in a society, in a world that continuously demands our erasure in order for us to survive. And so that's what my work is about. I'm out here just trying to create sustainable spaces of refuge and healing for our people in all the ways that I can, through scholarship, through activism, through art, and through sustaining myself as a essential part of the process. So, yeah.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Is hearing both of you talk about your work and who you are, it's so interesting because I can ask this question to lots of people and, you know, they get right into like their title and their professionalism. And I appreciate that you both started with like who you are, the essence of your being, right? And where you come from and how that influences your work. And to me, that speaks to your ability to be authentic, right? Like your work is authentic to who you are. You don't have like these hard separations between, okay, now I'm going to go in and be this person, right? And I can appreciate that. And I can appreciate the center and the work that's happening at the center and how that work comes from an authentic place. So thank you.
Thank
you. So to many, this may seem like a question with an obvious answer, but I think it's important to have you two frame it for the discussion that we're having today. Why is racial justice such an important part of education and scholarship in general, but I also think for higher education in particular? And I won't call on folks, so whoever wants to jump in.
You know, there's a lot of programming in Black and Brown communities geared towards college access.
Uh-huh.
There's a lot of programming that's asking for young people to get out of the violence of the streets. But it's like you get out the violence of the streets to go into the racial violence of institutions that again demand your erasure, demand that you abandon who you are. And that's on one level, but then we understand the carcerality and the relationship between the prison industrial complex and this nation's insistence on controlling Black bodies and how that feeds into schooling. So it's a violent anti-Black place.
Mm-hmm.
We want people to have college access, but college campuses are some of the most racist contexts in our country. And so we have all these measures of college and career readiness and getting students accepted. And it's like, accepted into what? Mm-hmm. Into spaces that were not built with them in mind and refused to value them. And so just thinking about the impact of that on students' lives, for me, the work of racial equity and racial justice has to be institutionalized if we're truly to heal the systemic level of anti-Blackness and harm that's going on in this nation. I'll stop there because I know Dr. Green has some thoughts too.
Yeah, I feel like we could spend the entire podcast unpacking this question, since I think we know public education are in the context of the US, it's race and racism is so entangled in all of it. And so in short, I echo all of what Dr. J outlined, and just sort of underscoring that the deep irony, sometimes I find, you know, deep irony in you know, legislation like No Child Left Behind, or you know, any of like Common Core state standards, any of the ways that there's rhetoric around we want to treat all, you know, all students the same, or fairness, sameness is fairness, all of that, assessment practices, evaluation, the ways that we think about instruction, curriculum design, if we aren't thinking about how they're either inhibitors or providing access, or who's left out, who benefits, you know, these are questions that we need to be asking at every point in the process. And so essentially what I'm saying, you know, we have teachers who are asked to love children, but it's very clear that that isn't playing out, right? And so to love all kids includes loving all of our communities as your, you know, so I need you to love my Black child enough not to frame and not to design curriculum in ways that would shut them out or our communities out. And so rambling a little bit there, but just essentially saying that it's baked into the fabric. And so if we're not talking about race or the ways that institutional systemic racism are impacting the ways that we construct classrooms and schools, then I'm not sure what we're doing. And so, you know, essentially I've decided that anything that we do, from my methods courses to practicum placements to, you know, thinking about curriculum design, it always has to consider how race is entangled in what we're doing.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I appreciate that. So walk me through your lives a bit. And I know we have time constraints, so, you know, a bit. But Dr. Green, let's begin with you. I've seen some of your research, and racial justice is certainly core to, you know, the center of your work. Your most recent scholarship, I think, is a 2020 piece that centers youth, in particular Black and Brown youth voices in qualitative research. I thought was really interesting. It seems impactful in shifting the way people think about qualitative work and whose voices and experiences are centered and heard. What about your life has brought you to centering racial justice as a profession? Because I feel with both of you, certainly doing some research before this podcast and knowing both of your work from being colleagues here at UMass, it's your profession in some ways, right? In ways that it perhaps isn't other people's profession who is doing similar work. So what about your lives have brought you to making this your profession?
Well, I mentioned some of it in the introduction. Just knowing that the work for me is not separated from who I am.
Yeah.
So I'm engaging in work that I'm hopefully, right? This is all a work in progress. Hopefully my attempt is to engage in work and create spaces and context and write pieces that I wanted growing up. And so I named the example of growing up in a small town and essentially having all white teachers and a curriculum that was sparse, if at all, reflective, a reflection of who I am. And so while I feel like I turned out okay, that's in large part because of my family, right? That's in large part because of the community context. That's in large part because, you know, I was intentionally a part of spaces that were, you know, pro-Black or intentional about connecting me to the legacies of our people and our histories and traditions. And so it's because of all of those spaces that I feel like I am, you know, confident in who I am and have a connection with all of my ancestors and sort of have this real, I think, healthy image of who I am as a Black woman, a Southern Black woman. But I imagine young people who might not have those same opportunities outside of schools, and schools are obviously places where young people spend a lot of time. And so I think I want to be producing work that necessarily requires that, as Dr. J mentioned, that erasure, that invisibility doesn't happen. And so that qualitative piece, or the qualitative pieces that I've written, really question how we engage in communities when we are saying we're conducting research. And so as a doctoral student, I was really uncomfortable with the notion of research. And so mostly because I was always just hanging out in communities with young people as a, you know, sort of community activist, you know, I was always hanging out. And so to put on a researcher hat felt like I was doing something that might betray the trust or undermine my connections. And so it wasn't until I started reading more work by BIPOC folk, you know, more work by folks outside of the field of education that helped me see there's a way that we can be in mutual reciprocal relationships with young people and communities. And so it doesn't have to look like I'm descending and parachuting in a community, descending upon a community to have my notebook out, take notes, study what young people are doing. I can engage as a volunteer and ask questions about what might be the need in those communities and how might research help answer questions or help with the activism that's happening in that space. And so I always love looking at tensions and places that are seem murky. And so for that last piece in particular, I was asking questions like, what does it mean to be conducting school-based research, but you might have a relationship with the student outside of school? And so that relationship outside of school reveals that that student is very clear about the sort of social mobility that might be available to her if she participates in school and graduates and gets the degree. In school, however, if you just knew her through, you know, her you know, behaviors or her actions in schools, you might describe her in a different way. You might describe her as apathetic and not really wanting to access, you know, sort of the benefits of an education. And so as a researcher, am I to solely collect data that presents itself inside the classroom, or am I considering this whole person and the conversations and also holding that nuance and the tensions and the complexity of her, both her desires, right? Her desires for social mobility, but also her naming very clearly the ways that school is a toxic, hostile place, boring, not reflect, you know, a reflection of who she is. And other questions like how we might use young people of color, you know, sort of to create our portfolio of programs, right? And so we might white organization that says I do youth development with, you know, youth of color and yay us, right? And we parade youth of color around without asking whether or not this is, you know, a way that we're exploiting young people. Black people, and, you know, exoticizing the woundedness of Black people. And so just the complexities, just sort of acknowledging that qualitative research, maybe any research for that matter, is not linear. There's complexity, there's layers, and you can't do without deep examination of who you are and thinking about the communities that you're working alongside.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
To edit any of that.
No, it's all good. We leave it all. It's all good. I mean, certainly I found little nuggets throughout all of that, and I think others will too. So Dr. J, I've watched your very famous TEDx talk. I think it has, that's, you know, three ways to speak English. And as a, similar to you, my mom is Jamaican. I was raised in a household that was Jamaican, African-American, born in Brooklyn. So that really resonated with me. And I think obviously it resonated with a lot of people because it's just under, I think, 5 million views, which is amazing. Since then, you've done a lot, including founder, co-director of the Ciphers for Justice, numerous scholar activist awards, accolades. So folks better Google both of y'all, right? So at the end of this, I hope that the listeners, they go and they Google both of you and they look at your bios, because you both have so many accomplishments and such significant impact already on both, you know, this work that you're doing, but also on our campus. Nonetheless, I want to hear a little bit about your life, Dr. J. You shared a little bit with us early on, but your research and the progression of your research and work that's brought you to, again, centering a profession in racial justice, right? Because you could have, you know, you're a poet as well, many things, you have many skills and expertise. So why choose to spend your profession working towards racial justice?
You know, we had a, we hosted a dialogue, a webinar, and Dr. Gloria Latin Billings was on just a few days ago. And she spoke to us about the, you know, not confusing the job with the work. The fact that when the job is done, the work is still there for those of us who are called to it, right? My work in racial justice is a divine calling for me. It transcends any institution or any genre or anything. Like it's my, it's a divine calling, a divine orientation that I take up in whatever capacity I'm blessed to have space in. Like I'm gonna take up space with this calling. And so for me, it really just came with the fact that I love Black people. I love my culture. My culture, Trinidad is one of the proudest countries on the planet. And the culture is so vibrant and colorful and dynamic and loud and rich. And then I'm from Brooklyn, and you already know how we do. Brooklyn, you know, planet Brooklyn is everything. And so again, I'm in a space that's so vibrant and proud and rich. And it's just like thick with the nuance of Blackness. And then I go to school and it's just like white middle-class texts. White middle-class values, Eurocentric, like mad stale, you know? So like for me, that juxtaposition of understanding the rich complexity of my own lives, the lives I live outside of school, and then going into school and being met with this one note discourse was just, it was nuts to me. It didn't feel right. And simultaneously, as a young person, I was a part of a youth poetry organization, a youth spoken word organization. And my peers, like we would like compete, like we did poetry slams. And it was actually the same organization that created where Amanda Gorman comes from. Like they created the same program, right? Like I was there at the time that program started. And we would end up on platforms like HBO, Madison Square Garden, Broadway, Apollo. And my peers were in schools where maybe they were, English was failing them. I would say English class was failing them. Like the schools were failing them. I, with my parents and my orientation, like I them A's was important in my household. But so that was a different energy. But it really helped me to understand the distinction between schooling and education in a very pronounced way. I know that my peers in that time, I'm like, yo, y'all are geniuses. How could you possibly be so impactful that your words that you penned made it onto Broadway, made it onto HBO, made it onto to in Madison Square Garden, but that genius can't be captured in your English classroom. You're feeling how? And so that disconnect really illuminated for me that school does not know how to value or capture what we are. Sure. And as I started to interrogate that some more, I came to the point of understanding how my own, and that's that TED talk, how my own language practices, I was being affirmed for standardized language practices that are really rooted in whiteness. And I'm like, oh, okay. They taught me how to like shuffle out different parts of my identity in order to be valued in what's deemed the intellectual space. Started to ask more questions about that and understood that it has a deep colonial, imperial, racist past to controlling language, to the mechanism of school as a tool of subjugation that we reify every day in K-12 and higher ed context. Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh, so we complicit in this history. And that became more and more of how I'm saying, like, how do I, Ciphers for Justice became a space where with colleagues of mine, we created it again, this space of intervention, not for the students, but for the institution, right? Mm-hmm. Intervention for an institution that apparently, institutions that don't know how to not cause this harm. How do we create spaces of refuge? How do we institutionalize anti-racism so that we could disrupt things on a systemic level? So this is just like where my calling is showing up right now in the world. But I'm of the mind that, you know, if I'm not here, look at what just, you saw what just happened to Cornel West?
Mm-hmm.
Is Harvard serious right now?
Yeah.
This is why these institutions, the difference between the job and the work. So this is a job. Yeah. To the degree that I can do the work in this job, I'm here for it. And to the degree that I can't, peace.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's... I love the situation of that, like how you situate those two, the job and your divine calling and all of that. So thank you for sharing that. I'm gonna have to re-listen to both of your answers to that question, because both of your answers gave so much insight to how this work is being done on college campuses and universities, but also the amount of energy that it takes from individuals to do this work, right? Like it's not just coming in and doing your job. It's so much, it goes so far beyond that. And talking with you two, that becomes so incredibly obvious, but I think talking with many other people that are doing work related to racial justice or social justice, the weight that folks have to carry, the intention, the energy and the effort that goes into it is way beyond a normal job or a normal profession. And I think, you know, you both highlight that beautifully. So thank you for that. So we have a few minutes. I want to transition. I want to ask one question that specifically will speak to instructors, faculty, people teaching, educating on our campus. We often hear from, at least in our office, we often hear from faculty who want to do more to center racial justice in their curriculums and their courses. What does racial justice in the classroom look like? I think certainly you both have explained that and illustrated that in just your discussions and answers to my questions thus far. But specifically, what does it look like in a classroom setting to teach for racial justice? And what sort of steps can educators take to decolonize their curriculum and make more racially just academic spaces for their students?
Yeah, I think many things. And I think we...
this is probably a whole nother podcast. Yeah. So I know you're gonna have to give me like the extremely abbreviated version, but...
No, it's cool. I mean, I think it's the... I mean, it's the question, right? It's the question of the moment. It's the question, you know, perennial question that keeps coming up. And I guess it, you know, for me, it depends on who's asking, right? So recently I had an opportunity to collaborate with the history department and they have their Feinberg series. And so I was able to collaborate with them to facilitate a workshop series and we called it Culturally Sustaining Pedagogies and Teaching for Black Lives. And in that, you know, not a surprise, but this area, it attracted, and there were a lot of white, you know, teacher participants, right? White teachers, administrators, co-curricular, you know, folks who lead co-curricular activities, librarians. And so it's no surprise that most of the teacher candidates with whom I work and in-service teachers are white women mostly. After that, white men. Occasionally, I might have a sprinkling of teachers of color. You know, I can count on one hand the number of Black teacher candidates that I've had. So I guess it depends on who is asking sometimes. But mostly, I think we should start by acknowledging and naming that these spaces are colonized spaces. These spaces are spaces that are disconnected from our lives, right? So excuse me, bump, you know, which we're talking about, I know I prioritize Black children, but let's just say everybody, right? Schools often don't reflect our lives, period. No matter who you are. And so I think just starting there to see, right? So often I ask folks to see and map from the aesthetics to the actual, you know, curricular content, policies, practices, sort of map what's happening in school spaces or in their sites, and name and acknowledge the ways that they are, you know, racist policies, spaces that have long and effectively, you know, continue to colonize folks and separate folks and differentiate folks along race, class, gender. And so I think that's a huge step, right? So that can take a while to do and name and acknowledge the ways that, for example, Dr. J named academic literacy practices. You know, there are folk who will just keep saying we're doing a disservice if we don't make sure our young people can access academic school-based language practices, right? And so what will happen if we don't make sure our young people aren't able to sort of construct a sentence grammatically correct, whatever, you know, whatever that means. And so there's a lot to unpack and have to unlearn and be comfortable with. I think that we're very uncomfortable with the notion that the literacy practices that happen easily in the hallways or in our homes are not the literacy practice to be valued inside schools. And that's just a, you know, that's a big hurdle. Or I often have educators who say, you know, I got you. Intellectually, I get culturally sustaining pedagogies. I get theories of learning that center marginalized identities. I don't, however, know how to make sure the young person passes these high stakes tests, right? And so my job is on the line. If I can't make sure that this classroom of students aren't passing tests and proficient in these ways. And so that always is a tension, as if the two are separate, as if you can't have a rigorous, whatever that means, curriculum that is justice, you know, centered around justice and equity. And so for me, those are things to grapple with and name and unpack. And so in terms of what it looks like, I think the mapping, the naming, the noticing, and a desire to let young people teach us, right? And so be willing to listen, because young people have long been saying, we've been saying, I've been saying as a kid myself, now adult, hearing other young people tell me very similar dynamics that are playing out. So listen, right? And so there's, you know, this idea that, are we listening to the subaltern? Are we listening to young people when they tell us what they need and want and desire for school spaces, school contexts? So that those are just a couple of, or a few things that I might suggest among many.
Yeah, thank you. How about you, Dr. J?
You know, when we were thinking about naming the center, we kept going mm-hmm. back and forth between the Center for Racial Justice and the Center of Racial Justice. And we ended up naming it the Center of Racial Justice with the notion that it's embodied, that we are of this. We're not just for it, we're of it, it's who we are. And I say that to say, this question comes up a lot, and I have no one sheet for anybody. I want us to be of racial equity, of valuing Black genius and humanity. Like, it needs to be who we are and how we see the world. I saw a tweet the other day that after everything, the nonsense going on in Texas, like the response to the government response, somebody said, you know, this country is not prepared for anything but war. Mm. Nobody ever has to ask America, how should we go to war? It's not a question. Everything is in place, set in stone, billions of dollars invested, ready, set, go. At the expense of every and anything, we will effectively go to war. Mm-hmm. No one has to ask this country how to effectively perpetuate capitalism. Every iteration of our lives is saturated with capitalism. Everything from what we see to what we do, how we think, we're of it. Mm-hmm. And then when it comes to the question of racial equity, all of a sudden, they don't know, right? I don't know, right? So it's like, what does that mean? What does it mean? It means that we are not of it. And so for me, there is no one sheet. I love Black children. So I will never be comfortable with seeing them harmed. I don't have a one sheet for that. I know that requires action. When I'm in any space, I know that requires intervention for the institution, you know? So for me, that's what it is. It's like, we start with saying, what does it mean for me to interrogate my lens, this system, in ways that transform the paradigms, the perspectives, how we even see this, so that it saturates who we are and what the stuff that we're made of.
Thank you. Thank you so much. So much of what you said is so powerful. I mean, I certainly hope people listen to this podcast in particular, because there's so much that we all can learn and take into our classroom and take into our professional spaces and take into our lives to be of the work, as you so beautifully said, Dr. J. So thank you so much for being here with us today. Is there anything else that you want to make sure that our listeners know here? I mean, certainly, Dr. J, what you left us with at the end there is powerful and impactful, but I want to give you that opportunity.
We want to make sure that you know about our upcoming launch in April.
Yes.
So we want to make sure that folks listening, that they come and bring a friend or two. We have a really exciting, engaging all the senses, virtual launch coming up April 21st, 22nd, and 23rd. And so we hope listeners will join us, check us out. There'll be a lot for a lot of people, right? So we'll have young people at the forefront, and we have everything from DJs to keynotes by Dr. Sean Jenwright, Dr. Bettina Love, Dr. Cynthia Dillard. We also have youth poet laureate. We also have an award-winning chef. So we're thinking about mind, body, soul, thinking about that embodied work. So we invite folks to check that out.
Thank you. And I will make sure that when we post this podcast, we post additional information about the launch. So, all right. So Dr. Liscott and Dr. Green, I want to thank you so much for being here with me today to talk about the UMass Center of Racial Justice and about why racial justice is such an important part of higher education and scholarship here at UMass. Thank you for tuning in to the Dignity and Respect Action podcast. Tune in again for our final episode of the Black Experience at UMass series, when I will be joined by Professor John Bracey, Dr. Whitney Battle-Baptiste, and graduate student Erica Slocum as we dive into the Black Presence Initiative. Thank you.